The letter to the Ephesians is one of my favorites. Indeed, ever since reading the Bible as a child and through the years, I always found Ephesians to be a relatively easy resting place. It's beautiful and instructive and it's broad, and I don't find it punitive the way I find St. Matthew's Gospel. St. Matthew seems to say, get up on your tiptoes, you're not high enough yet, now just stay up there and see how it feels. It's not a pleasant read for me to read Matthew, and it is not overly mystical as John's Gospel is so often, such as in the reading we heard this morning. The letter to the Ephesians was written in about 100 of the Common Era, so there are at least two generations of Christians underway in the world. It was written in a large Gentile city in the Roman world, and it was a syncretic world full of choices to make about life and temptations and diversions. A few years ago, my wife Elspeth and I went on a tour of the ancient city of Ephesus. Only about 10% of it has been unearthed. The rest of it lies under about 40 feet of sludge. But what has been unearthed has been restored, and it is absolutely magnificent. There it stands as it stood in the ancient world. Storefronts and mosaic floors and individual shops into which you can walk, and a building called the Great Library at one end, and along the way, a Roman toilet has to be right in the middle of the main street. And as we were getting towards the end where the harbor used to be, the guide said, does anyone know what that building is? And I put up my hand and said, it's a brothel. And he said, you're right. And no one would sit beside me on the bus for the rest of the trip. I couldn't understand that. It was a sheer guess on my part. There were only a few stones left. And along the way, you'd find the shape of a pizza drawn in the cement of the sidewalk or in the stone, and it read the signs, Jesus Christ, Son of God, Savior, when you put all the Greek letters together. And up the hill from where those stones were would be someone's home, and that home would be a Christian church. So walking along the street, you had directions on the stones as to how to get to the brothel for the sailors, they're still there, and also how to get to the church if you wanted to go there, a very complex city. And in the passage that Dennis read today, the author is pressing the reader to be intentional about their faith and their living. Be intelligent, he writes, not senseless. Be focused, don't drift. Be sober, not staggering all over the place and looking like a fool. Take stock of yourself in the light of the grace of God. And as I was rethinking this, does anybody do that in this culture? Does anyone get up in the morning and say, I wonder how my life and my decisions are fitting in terms of the grace of God, the ultimate purpose of God in the world? An interesting question. He also says, create an earworm that feeds the soul. Hear helpful, beautiful music inside your head. And we do that. We sing our faith. Indeed, I remember a group of preachers gathering at a seminar one day, and the Old Testament professor stood up and she said to us, you preachers, don't get up on your high horse too much. Congregations do not learn their faith from your sermons. They learn their faith by singing the hymns. And that is true. O love that wilt not let me go, I rest my weary soul in thee. You can sing that to me as I'm breathing my last breath. Finish then thy new creation, pure and spotless let us be. How is that for inspiration for the day? And on the other side of the radio dial, hold on tight to your dreams, ELO. Or rise up by the Parachute Club. Or don't stop thinking about tomorrow, it'll be here better than before. That song got me through my life when my first marriage ended. I stood in the empty living room, played the cut over and over again, and danced myself back to health. We rise again from a distance. We all have earworm songs. And be direct in your concern for each other. Never mind the quick happy birthday you write on the Facebook page and send off, often without much of a second thought. I sent two of them this morning, two of them to people I barely know. Happy birthday anyway. Be more intentional than that in your relationships, says the writer of Ephesians. This is what the poet Robert Burns wrote to a woman named Miss Leslie Bailey in May of 1793. She was a young lass, and he only met her once in the company of her father, but listen to the intention of his writing. "I have some pretense, madam, to make you up the theme of my song, as you and I are two downright singularities in human nature. You will probably start at this assertion, but I believe it will be allowed that a woman exquisitely charming, without the least seeming consciousness of it, and a poet who never pays a compliment but where it were justly due, are two of the greatest rarities in earth." Isn't that a great piece? I get Burns to write all my letters to people that I want written. These directives in Ephesus make a tall order for us. How do we make these choices today in a world which is even bigger and broader and more diverse and seemingly more at risk and more unbalanced and polarized, easily at war, on fire, and in the midst of a pandemic? Surprisingly enough, it's time to get religious. It's time to get religious. If I ask King Solomon, of whom we read today, if he were a religious person or a spiritual person, I think he would say, spiritual. You see, because if you're a spiritual person, you can keep your options open. Well, I like this and I like that, but I don't want to come down too hard anywhere. And Solomon would say, look, I'm trying to keep my hands on the wheel of the state, and so I'm going to take the broad turns and take them slowly enough to see where we're going. Life, you see, is like a whack-a-mole game, says Solomon, and you just wait for the mole to come up and you whack it. And for that, you need to be generally spiritual, not coming down too hard on this or that. And the story went on to say that Solomon went to Gibeon to offer a flashy and opulent sacrifice on a generic altar which stood at Gibeon. I thought that was important. Gibeon, you see, is a multi-layered symbol in the world of Israel. It was the scene of the first Jewish victory, the fall of the walls of Jericho, so long ago. And Gibeon had been a place of human occupation for 3,000 years before Solomon made his visit, an old human setting. It was also considered a national historic site, like Arlington National Cemetery in the United States, the former home of Robert E. Lee, the Kennedy Flame, the Iwo Jima statue, which has recently been restored. It is huge, and the flag which flies above it must be 100 feet long, a massive thing. Gibeon was also known as the Field of Swords. In battle, 12 of the king's men, David, and 12 of his enemy, great warriors, stood and hacked away at each other until none was left standing, and David was declared the victor, a sacred place of war. And it was also a place of dreams. This is where Solomon had his great dream. And he prayed for humility, wise man, and he was given riches and power for the length of his life and beyond it. That's some dream. Now, if you're spiritual, maybe you don't have to commit. Maybe. Maybe you can be a tourist in life. You can say of things, maybe this, maybe that. You can say, I'll take as much or as little as I choose of something. You can say, we can turn back at this point, or I choose to ride the wind a little further. Life is a smorgasbord, we say. It's not a prefix menu. You can eat what you like. It's trendy to be spiritual. It makes you sound urbane to be spiritual. I say, have you read the latest book of how to wrap your legs around your arms and feel better about yourself? I have. And it's like looking out the window rather than striding out the door. Now, the key, as I've suggested, strangely enough, perhaps coming from me, is that it's time again to be religious. And here's the difference. A call came into Metropolitan Church a number of years ago from the International Rugby Federation. I didn't know them. Rugby to me is a game that my son played in which you wrap duct tape around your head so people don't tear your ears off. Not exactly my kind of game. But this call was looking for a singer to sing Flower of Scotland at an international meet between Team Scotland and Team Canada at BMO Field. You're from the St. Andrews Society. Can you find us a singer? They said. Well, I said, I'll look around. I put the word out and nothing happened. And months later, I got a call back saying we couldn't find anybody. I said, all right, I'll do it. Well, they said, you'll have to be here for the rehearsal on the Friday night. So I went out to BMO Field just in my coat and walked in, and the woman said, just sit here in the stands and wait till your turn. The Canadian team is practicing on the field. So I sat up in the very last seat, and the team was scrimmaging and tearing each other's ears off, and suddenly they stopped the play, and the coach pointed at me and said, get that man out of here. And I looked around, and it was me. And I went running out into the hall and hid near the Coke machine until the practice was over, and then I went in and rehearsed. But the next day, you see, that's being spiritual, by the way. The next day, the performance day, I put on my 78th Fraser Highlanders British Scarlets with the kilt and the sash and the bonnet with the bear hackle and the sword and the belt and the augulets, and I strode over to BMO Field, and the crowd in front of the door parted like the Red Sea. And I walked in and they said, are you the singer? I said, I am. Religion, particular. I walked out on the field and sang, oh, flower of Scotland, when will we see your like again? 20,000 fans on their feet screaming. And walking out through underneath the portico, 11 young boys, 12 years old, all giving thumbs up to an old man in a red suit. That's religion. It's particular. It's obvious. Yes, I'm the singer, and I have an anthem to sing which will lift you to your feet. There is the difference. Now, I know there are dangers and narrowness things in religion. There are abuses in religion. We know that. Arrogance, entitlement, inappropriate financial benefits, evangelists flying around in private jet planes and all the rest. Psychological and physical damage done by the church. How many times I've had people, strangers to me, come into the office and begin to cry because the way church has hurt them over the years of their life. Crooked dealings, power plays, wolves dressed in sheep's clothing. I know that. The Crusades, the Protestant Reformation, the martyrs. Indeed, in the 5 years of the reign of Queen Mary of England, 300 people were burnt at the stake. The issue was heresy against Catholic doctrine. And in the reigns of Edward VI and Elizabeth I, over 56 women, family members, tradesmen, and children were hanged, drawn, and quartered by the state for the same thing. Such zealots are safe from social blame and personal regret because, you see, they are doing God's will, and religion leaves them carte blanche. Tremendously dangerous to be religious. But it's time to be religious. If you're going to be a Christian, then be a particular follower of Jesus Christ. There is so much to learn, more than the postage stamp information this modern culture gives. Read of him. Read what the great writers have said of him. Listen to the music that has been inspired by his spirit. Pray to him and speak with him. Use the vision you see. Because we gain things for living from following Jesus Christ intentionally. We learn how life works. Oh, it's terribly difficult in the middle. There is a call that awakens us. We will suffer pain and loss, but in the end, by the glory of God, we will be lifted up into that world we have sensed in our broadest and deepest moments. There's a sense of rescue and homecoming at the heart of Christian faith. A lost sheep restored. Rejoice, I have found my sheep. There's a call to face the real world. Sitting down among those cutting themselves in tombs, sitting beside the bodies of dead children whose parents are wailing over them, wishing for another outcome, walking in the streets where people are suffering and being pushed around by political power. It's all there. Yes, you will find pain and discomfort. It's called ministry in the steps of Jesus of Nazareth. The spirited stand back and refuse to get involved. I'm spiritual. It's like spraying yourself with Pam every day so you don't stick to anything. But the religious person braves the heat of the oven, the variety of experiences through the prism of the story of Jesus. A full meal, tasty, rich, nourishing, and plenteous. It's costly and it's spicy, but it's worth it. Now, the writer of John's Gospel makes it very personal. We just don't admire Jesus, or categorize Jesus, or study the phenomenon of Jesus, or bump into Jesus vaguely on the subway. We actually eat his flesh and drink his blood. That's pretty intimate, isn't it? Who eats me will draw life from me, says John's text. Well, what's that like? We've been living at our cottage since a year ago, March. We grabbed a plastic bag on the 12th of March when the pandemic was coming to town, and we drove to the cottage for a couple of days and stayed 16 months and spent the winter there, and we didn't see anybody, and we're still married. And then when things got a bit lighter, and we have a second cottage next door, our children would come on occasion and bring their children and their dog, and they would sleep there, and we would sleep here, and there were designated areas in which we could go and could not go. But over the last summer, and over the winter, and this summer, we have come to know our grandchildren, not just as people of whom you have pictures in your foyer, but real personalities, 13 and 11, full of vinegar and smart remarks, and the older ones driving through, very anxious to see Grandpa and Grandma, who figured, very anxious to be where we are. We love this place, they say, and so we would do whatever families do. You put on the barbecue, and you have a red meat night, and you sit around the table, and you laugh at each other, and then we play a game called Best Part of the Day, and everyone gets to say in order what the best part of the day was, and then the storytelling starts, and after a few glasses of wine, my wife begins to regret the story she's been telling, but the kids remember. The kids say, you know, we were telling our friends that story that Grandma told the other night, and Grandma, of course, has left the room by this point, but years from now, our kids are going to know us, and our grandchildren are going to remember us, and it's going to be because we have drunk each other's blood and eaten each other's flesh. We've taken time to do it. That intimacy makes our hearts sing, and that is what is at the heart of following Jesus Christ. Now, it's a new season after COVID, and much has changed, and there's a reluctance in people to return to large groups, to churches. I don't know how churches are going to survive when we finally get through the fourth wave, but there is strength in leadership, and this church has pivoted, as have others, in new ways of expressing themselves and new ways of expressing faith, and they're quite remarkable. But it seems to me that the secular drift among which we live is increasing and hope in the sacred is declining. But you see, the big questions still remain. Who shall we be? How shall we be? Who shall we love? Whom shall we fear and stand against? How shall we seek the highest and best for all of us in this generation and in the future? And spirituality, sweet though it may be, will not cut it there. Oh, it's a lot better than mockery and abusing sacred things and persecuting those who take it seriously, a lot better. But religion that is well lived offers intelligence, historical precedence, life understanding. It makes well-formed thoughts and worthy paragons of humanity maturing and rising up before us to live among us. And by God, we're going to need those.